What is the most delicious thing in the world? Beluga caviar? A filet mignon, medium rare? Spicy double fried French fries?
We're just going to get some hollandaise fried up.
Hollandaise.
Yeah, these are big cubes of hollandaise.
Today in Studio 360, we're going to check out a radical new approach to food from celebrity chef Wiley Dufresne.
There's our liquid nitrogen delivery for the day being
the liquid nitrogen.
We had a course that tasted like Fruit Loops. We had a drink that tasted like a Tootsie Pop. We had a dessert course that tasted like pancakes, maple syrup, and smoked sausage.
Wiley has reinvented Eggs Benedict, and we're going to make it with him start to finish, including a field trip to the hen house.
I'm getting pecked in the back of my leg.
Oh.
It's not the first time.
Hungry yet? It is all ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Well, you can really feel them coming on now. The holidays are just around the bend. And with them, of course, there'll be the requisite office parties and frenzied shopping, ubiquitous music, family gatherings, and, yes, regardless of which holidays we celebrate, one thing we all have in common is food.
Hi.
Whether we're picking out, dieting, or just obsessive.
I'd like the chef salad, please, with the oil and vinegar on the side and the apple pie a la mode.
Chef and apple a la mode.
But I'd like the pie heated, and I don't want the ice cream on top. I want it on the side, and I'd like strawberry instead of vanilla if you have it. If not, then no ice cream, just whipped cream, but only if it's real. If it's out of a can, then nothing.
Not even the pie?
No, just the pie, but then not heated.
Uh-huh.
And these days, of course, food isn't just sustenance. It's entertainment.
The time has come to once again answer life's most savory question. Whose cuisine reigns supreme? This is Iron Chef America.
Today in Studio 360, we're going to follow the art and science of a delicious meal. What do we need? Fresh ingredients? Check. An array of special tools? Check. A spirit of invention? Check.
I was at a dinner party, and the two guys next to me were talking to each other and said, wouldn't it be cool if you could have deep-fried mayonnaise? And I was like, oh, yes, it would.
That is Wiley Dufresne, the proprietor of WD50, a chic, expensive restaurant in Lower Manhattan. Dufresne was trained in classical French cuisine, but today he's a big name in the trend called molecular gastronomy. His cooking combines a kind of chemistry-set, do-it-yourself attitude with a very playful approach to flavor and texture. Like when he makes his version of the Japanese rice flour thingy called mochi.
He's taking glutinous rice flour and mixing it with olives that have been dehydrated and a modified starch, and he's making a dough out of it that he's going to poach, and then he's going to dehydrate, and then he's going to fry, and it's going to actually souffle and have a really crunchy, crispy exterior and that chewy, doughy interior with the flavor of black olives.
And in one of his dishes at WD50, he cooks a classic French tureen of foie gras, then freezes it into a hard sheet, shatters the sheet, and serves the shards. Today we'll see how Wiley reinvents one of my favorites, Eggs Benedict. On one wall in his kitchen are shelves full of plastic jars that look not really very appetizing.
The pharmacy, as it's affectionately known.
Well,
I mean,
that's
not a term that we've coined. It's a term that everyone else has. But these are all various gums, stabilizers, hydrocolloids, if you will, that have helped us to manipulate texture in some very interesting ways.
I mean, up on the top, I see things that I have in my kitchen, like Tabasco and fish oil and all those things.
That's the staff meal chef. So,
and do you suddenly get in your head, I want to do this, I want to make a thing that feels like this and looks like this out of this strange thing, and you get a scientist on the phone to say, how can I do this? Or will you help me with this?
Sometimes it works like that. Sometimes we're introduced to a new ingredient. We don't know anything about it. And we just start picking it apart and run it through a sort of a battery of tests and to see what it'll do. And then a dish may grow out of that.
And does it ever go badly and you go like, Jesus, why was I ever thinking of using this or doing this?
Probably the one we've been failing at the longest is hot ice cream.
Not fried ice cream, which one sees?
No. We've been trying to make something that has the exact same temperature, mouthfeel, melt back as cold ice cream, but could be served warm. Once you start to realize that there are, say, gums that can withstand heat, and gums are used to texturize things, and virtually every commercial ice cream, if you read the back of a label, which has become something I can't stop doing, is reading the ingredient list and products in the supermarket, you realize that there are gums in there. And then for me, it was about working backwards. Well, if there are gums that help stabilize ice cream when it's cold, and there are other gums that are stable in warm conditions, might we be able to sort of flip the whole thing? I have, a whole file cabinet's worth of failed experiments. But out of those failed experiments have come some very interesting things.
One of your, I guess, relatively recently invented dishes, which sounds completely familiar and normal, Eggs Benedict, which is on your tasting menu. You perfected this really like within the last year or so?
Well, I would resist the word perfected.
Started serving?
We've been serving it, yes, for less than a year now.
And did you begin with Eggs Benedict because it is so, at this point, so deeply familiar and common of a thing? And it was fun to mess around with something so familiar?
Well, we had been asked to be part of a book called The Egg. And we didn't have a clue as to what we were going to do for the book.
And what you're holding there is what looks like a plastic baggie, that like maybe a frozen fruit dessert thing would come in. Icy pop, but it's that's all egg yolk?
This is just egg yolk, salt, and a little bit of cayenne pepper.
Those are a lot of eggs.
Yeah, and so we take these eggs, the yolks, we whisk them up, and we take a tube, we make it, and then we just dump the yolks in there, fill the sleeve up, tie it off. We let it sit overnight so that any residual air can rise to the
refrigerated,
top.
Refrigerated,
yeah. Absolutely. And then the next day, we set up a water bath here, and we'll just drop all these in here, and they'll cook for about 18 minutes. And
so you're sort of poaching the egg?
Yeah, we're poaching the yolk, and when we're done, it's going to have a texture of cheese or fudge or something.
But not like
a
hard-boiled egg? No,
that's more like chalk.
Yeah.
Let's put some in the C-vat.
So they start off as like 10-inch tubes, and you turn them into inch and a half long.
We trim them into little plugs, again, that are very similar to almost like a short cork, I'd say.
Now, once you've done that, once you've made these little pure egg yolk plugs, have you messed around with it and done other things with it just to see what would happen?
Absolutely. We've done a bunch of stuff with it. Pounded out into sheets and put it on a plate that looks like a slice of American cheese.
Uh-huh.
We've tried pounding it and then wrapping other things in it. It's a couple degrees more, and it becomes a little bit more pliable.
Mm-hmm.
We've taken this and mixed it, put it in a pastry bag, and piped it on a plate so it looks like a noodle. We've done a number of things with it.
You remind me of like the 19th century American scientist inventor who doesn't have the doctorate or the credential, but is sort of making strides and inventing extraordinary things by having just enough knowledge to be dangerous.
Well, I don't know. We certainly have no credentials, and I hope that we're not dangerous, but we're trying. We are better cooks today than we were yesterday, than we were 5 years ago, because we're using science to help us learn what's happening when we cook.
If I were to go back and film you as a child, were you messing around with your chemistry set?
No, I was a horrible science student. I have a degree in philosophy,
But this was a kitchen like none I've seen. Put a card in the slot, and onto the screen pops a picture of just how your dish will look, plus all the ingredients you need to cook.
Wiley's kitchen is full of state-of-the-art electronics and gadgets, like a stainless steel water bath that you can set to the fraction of a degree, which is handy for poaching those eggs.
No need for the bride to feel tragic. The rest is push-button magic.
But Wiley's favorite tool, he told me, is much more old school, the whisk. I thought that if you'd seen one whisk, you'd seen them all, but not so. I asked an expert, Gourmet Magazine style editor Corky Pollan, to explain.
I cook a lot. And if you cook, there are always those questions as to tools, because they do make a difference. You know, what kind of grater you use makes a difference. What kind of spatula? The outcome is affected by the tools you use. Whisks have two purposes, actually. There are ones for emulsifying, it's incorporating ingredients, and ones for aerating. Some of them do both of those processes, and some are better for one process over the other. Size matters. Both the size of the whisk and the size of the bowl or pot that you're going to use. If you can only invest in one whisk, this would be the whisk to invest in, the French whisk. It's a little smaller than the balloon whisk. It's great if you need less of the whipped cream. It's great if you want to emulsify because it gets into the corners of a pot. It has the silicone handle, which OXO does all the time, and it's just ergonomic and really feels good in the hand. It's easy to use. It doesn't tire your hand. And it also balances well. Often with a whisk, you're just leaning it against your bowl, and many of them just fall over and mess up the counter. And this one is weighted, so it can really lean against your mixing bowl.
The Omelet Show! Today on The French Chef.
Julia Child always called them whips. I think it's just maybe the different, maybe a translation from the French. Because I think until she started really using it on TV, most households in America, I don't think, had whisks. I think they used the egg beaters, those old-fashioned egg beaters. I don't think my mom had a whisk when I was growing up.
Corky Pollan, the style editor of Gourmet Magazine. You can see her favorite whisk at studio360.org. Today, we're watching Chef Wylie Dufresne make a radical version of Eggs Benedict. And in a moment, we'll go in search of the perfect eggs to make it with.
If you reach in there and she's protecting her eggs, you can get...
Peck at you?
Sure.
That's ahead in Studio 360. Stay with us.
What's to eat?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
What's to drink?
Good food galore.
Today, we're talking about the art and science of a delicious meal with the chef Wylie Dufresne, who owns the New York restaurant WD50.
I had monkfish with pepper oatmeal. I know, interesting.
We were surprised that one of the desserts had bacon bits on it. That was interesting and unexpected.
There was like this sweet, looked like ash on top of artichoke.
Dufresne is a leader in the cutting-edge food movement called molecular gastronomy, which takes a sort of mad scientist approach to cooking.
I think they use liquid nitrogen to sort of blast the foie gras into like mini pieces.
Today, we're making his version of Eggs Benedict.
I love eggs. It's my favorite food.
Really?
Yeah. We buy our eggs from Knollcrest Farms at the Green Market every Wednesday and every Saturday. We go through 120 dozen eggs a week.
Wow.
So,
2,000 eggs a week?
Yeah.
Knollcrest Farm is where Wylie gets all those eggs. It's about 100 miles north of New York City in the beautiful rolling hills of Dutchess County, not far from the Hudson River. Alice Meserich and Elizabeth Ryan own the farm.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Kurt.
Hi, Kurt.
Hi, nice to meet you.
And also joining us is an animal scientist, Cynthia Shelley from the State University of New York. So, Alice, how many chickens do you have in all?
What are you running? About 7,000 now, and down here, 6,000.
And most of those thousands of eggs are going to New York City or thereabouts?
Most of them, yes. Yeah. But we bought this farm in 79. We bought the other farm in 72.
Mm-hmm.
So, been here quite a while.
And did people care that it was organic in 1972? Or?
No, I think they wanted fresh eggs.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of five chicken houses you have?
Yes.
Yeah?
Well, four operating now.
Most of them have two floors, so we have birds upstairs and downstairs. And typically, the birds in one floor are all the same age.
Like a dorm.
Like a dorm, exactly.
So they're just, those the chickens that are that I'm seeing looking out at us through that fencing, they're free to run around in there?
They walk, they're free in the pen. They uh-huh. hop in a nest to lay eggs. They have plenty of water and feed. They're not allowed outside because birds outside can go to the hawks, the foxes,
for their own good,
the coons,
there,
the
yeah.
whatever. They're protected in yeah, there yeah. From critters.
Yeah, yeah. And if a raccoon gets in here, do you know it because you hear them? I mean, the chickens must scream, right?
They do.
Yeah.
But usually by the time you hear the screaming, it's too late. And that's very upsetting to them. And they will stop laying for a few days.
Really?
It's very, very traumatic. I guess a couple of months ago we had something, maybe it was a fox, get into number three and kill 10 chickens and traumatize everybody else, of course. And what, you know, that's part of the life cycle. You'll see as they get a little older, they get a little mangy looking because, you know.
So do we.
You know, and you're going to see a whole range of ages of birds here on this farm.
Were you always a lover of chickens? And I mean,
no, well, I married into a chicken farm. I grew up on a dairy farm.
Uh huh. That's like marrying in a different religion, right? I mean,
well, it's all agriculture. It's all working with critters, if you will. Yeah.
How do you like them?
Oh, I do.
Yeah. And their variety of breeds.
There's a Rhode Island Red White Rock Cross that lays brown eggs, mm-hmm. and a White Leghorn that lays white eggs.
When you come in every day to take their eggs out, there's no resistance or, oh, you're taking my eggs kind of activity, no?
Well, you can get, if you're reaching in there and she's protecting her eggs, you can get...
Back at you?
Sure. They're my eggs.
This breed also, from the hatchery that you get it from, is a breed that's not tending to go broody, which means they want to sit on eggs. And they have a totally different vocalization that they do. Huh. They'll puff right up and kind of growl at you, go, "Arr!" So I've got friends that have birds that they keep out on pasture. And if they get a broody one out there, they have a little milk crate. They put it in the four-wheeler. They put the hen in the milk crate and take her for a trip around the farm and bring her back. And usually that breaks her from being broody.
I'm getting pecked in the back of my leg, didn't I? It's not the first time.
thanks for letting us come up.
Our pleasure. Let's make sure they get some eggs. Okay. Got to send some eggs back to the studio. You'll never get them any fresher unless you come to the farm and pick them up yourself.
That was Elizabeth Ryan, who co-owns Knollcrest Farm, with Alice Meserich. We also heard from Professor Cynthia Shelley of the State University of New York. All that fresh air and poultry got me hungry, so let's head back to the New York kitchen of Wiley Dufresne at his restaurant, WD-50.
We had a course that tasted like Fruit Loops. We had a drink that tasted like a Tootsie Pop. We had a dessert course that tasted like pancakes, maple syrup, and smoked sausage. And none of those ingredients were in any of those dishes.
But all of it combined somehow was very childhood-like, and we think Barbie hair.
Yeah. And it was great.
Today we're making something more basic, Eggs Benedict.
You know, I've read about the heat in kitchens and never until this moment experienced it. And I'm sure this isn't even as hot as it gets.
Wiley really does love those fresh organic eggs from Knollcrest Farm, but his cooking also relies on some of the sorts of chemicals you'd see on a packet of Twinkies.
It's interesting, as the rest of us over these last 30 years have sort of been taught that we should, you know, go natural and go organic. And when we read the ingredients on the side of a package, we go, "Ew, look at all these chemicals I'm eating." You've sort of swum in precisely the opposite direction. I'm saying, hey, maybe these things are useful and interesting.
Well, they are, but I'm still using, you know, delicious lamb. And I'm buying the same carrots that the slow food people are. But no, I don't think it's at odds. I mean, it's important that we find out how these things are made and what goes into it. And are they, in fact, you know, safe? And if so, How can we incorporate them into our repertoire with in some smart, clever, interesting ways?
Scientists have been bringing us better living through chemistry, creating and tinkering with regular supermarket food for decades. Scientists like John Coupland, who teaches at Penn State. His field is, quote, ingredients as materials. He recently co-authored a paper about making ice cream at higher temperatures. I asked John Coupland to join us at Restaurant WD50.
I think there's a freedom in this world towards genuine innovation, which is much harder in the mass market food industry. And it's interesting to think about creativity. I think chefs and scientists have very different views of creativity, but they're both very good ways of solving problems.
Formally, ingredients as materials is your subject. What does that mean in the course of a course that you teach?
I think it's thinking about the ingredients in a food as the materials that build up that food structure. We're very used to thinking about plastics and steel and concrete as being combinations of different types of ingredients which fit together in certain ways to deliver certain properties. We're very uncomfortable thinking like that with foods. The idea of if you're going to make a cheese sauce, the different ingredients are contributing different material properties. Something is helping give it a smooth texture. Something is making it very viscous when it's hot. Something is going to make it set up when it cools down a little bit. And the studying the chemicals and the processes that go into that, we take a material science approach. And we try and apply that stuff to foods.
Which people, as you're suggesting, kind of naturally resist because cooking and eating is in this other human folk tradition than what people take as a matter of course in steel and brick and concrete.
Completely fascinating. I think how if you look at a food label, and you mentioned earlier about look at all these chemicals in the food, ooh, the food industry is very aware of that reaction, puts a huge amount of effort to reduce the label to have as few things listed as they possibly can. And now in this context, in Wiley's context, much more free to innovate and deliver the functionality, as we call it, the properties of enjoyed during eating, using whatever is necessary.
Well, I hope so. I mean, we're trying to be responsible. We're trying to, understand the ingredients. I mean, there's our liquid nitrogen delivery for the day, you can see.
Being the liquid nitrogen.
But there are a number of ingredients that I have downstairs that I have not used because I'm not satisfied with how they're made.
What gives you pause?
Let's say that it's completely manufactured, generated in a laboratory.
Right.
You know, they can create strawberry flavor, and they can deliver it to you in a jar, and it can be the most delicious strawberry
so
you ever have, but there's
no
strawberry
so
in it.
So what stops you from using it?
Because I'm conflicted. Not that I necessarily think it's wrong, but I haven't convinced myself that it's okay.
John, should Wiley have qualms or pause about using entirely lab-created ingredients?
I think he should have pause because he's running a business. But the ingredients that you're allowed to use in food, certainly in the food industry, are very tightly regulated and controlled. People have given a lot of thought about this. They know the molecules which are present in those ingredients. If you took something like a dried mushroom extract, you have no idea what chemicals are in that at all. Things can be quite comfortably poisonous and natural. And as a scientist, I know that the distinction between natural and synthetic is not a helpful one.
Penn State food scientist John Coupland. We're making Eggs Benedict today, along with Wiley Dufresne in his kitchen at WD50, and our yolks are poaching in the water vat. And so what are the other components of this?
The other major component is the hollandaise. We have a couple of batches here.
Yeah,
this is a double batch.
Of yolks and whites.
Yolks and whites.
Separated.
And the butter is melted right over there. And ostensibly what we need to do is we need to get the different hydrocolloids in here that are going to help with the functionality of the product.
Hydrocolloids, again, being thickening agents.
They're long-chain polysaccharides.
And it looks like the stuff that you'd see splattered on people in a Nickelodeon program.
It does have that sort of unpleasant sort of, you know, Ghostbusters-type vibe to it.
Yeah, kind of gooey.
It is. And this one is a starch. This one is, a waxy maize starch that's been pre-hydrated in such a way so that we can just whisk it into water. We don't have to cook it out the way you cook out flour or cornstarch. It's been instantized, like Tang or something like that, or
uh-huh.
Ovaltine. They've been instantized so that you can stir them into your drink without them fisheyeing or clumping or doing something like that. And so what we're going to do basically is we're going to put the yolks in the blender. We're going to add these gums to it. And then the trick was we need, Once the hollandaise is done in the blender, it has to be poured out. And then the only way to portion it that we could figure out, or the most effective way to portion it, was to take the sauce, the emulsion, and gel it so that we could cut it. We could shape it however we wanted. And then ultimately we thought, of course, the right thing to do would be to bread it in English muffin.
Crumbs?
Yeah. So we buy a case of English muffins a week, and we dry them in the oven, grind them up. The fryer, John, the fryer's on, right? The fryer is over there. So we're just going to get some hollandaise fried up.
So those are essentially large dice.
Yeah, these are big cubes.
Inch by inch cubes.
Big cubes of hollandaise that are now frozen.
Now, have you thought about, like, if that was available in my supermarket, I'd buy those. Why don't you sell Wiley Dufresne, hollandaise cubes?
You know, there was a time when we came up with the mayo, and I thought, okay, deep fried mayonnaise, you know, McDonald's is going to call me, and I'm going to get rich. I bought a special red and yellow phone for when they called and everything, you know, figuring that this is it.
There are chefs working in food companies now in collaboration with food scientists who would probably take it from that next step. Look, here's an idea. Here's something that basically works. Now let's see. Can we do this in a toaster oven? And we can't see fried mayonnaise on the shelves now. But in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, we might do. This is where ideas like this come from.
Should we go to the fryer? Yeah. Will you give these to Rich?
So you put 20 or so of the cubes into the deep fat. How long do those cook?
Just until they're golden brown. I mean, they're still cold in the center, so we're going to finish them in a low oven to heat through.
Uh-huh.
So there you go. They're nice and golden brown. I mean, you want to taste one? It's not, you can see it's not warm yet.
Right. Mmm.
But it's getting there.
It's getting there.
It's getting there. It's gonna have some acidity. It's gonna, again, the idea is that it's the texture of a hollandaise on a plate.
I mean,
it's
I could have 10 of those and that's my dinner. I mean, that's
And I'd sit right next to you, and I'd be happy to pump your heart.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Rich, do you have some yolk? We have hollandaise in the oven.
No, this is...
This is the Canadian bacon.
Ah, that looks good. And these are chives.
And this is black salt from Cyprus.
Wow, beautiful. It looks... Salt would have been low on my list of guesses for what that is. And one of these eggs, of the two on each plate, you sort of mash down with your thumb.
I kind of like that there are certain elements on the plate that are very, like, sharp and clean and geometric, and then there's a certain organic element to the plate as well. It's sort of a nice blend of the two. Food is hot. Food goes to the table. You guys want to sit down and we'll bring you some plates?
Excellent.
All right.
Excellent. It is finally time to settle into a cozy booth and tuck into this amazing-looking dish. It's like a cubist sculpture of Eggs Benedict, this big white plate with an arty arrangement of geometric shapes in the middle, two smooshed yellow cylinders of yolk, two breaded cubes, that's the fried hollandaise, this delicate leaf of Canadian bacon draped over them, topped with chives and that mysterious black salt. And I hate eating alone, so I have company here. John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet magazine, and he's also appeared as the science guy on the show America's Test Kitchen. And Marcia Pelshaw works at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. She is a biopsychologist, which means that she studies how people develop their tastes and distastes for certain foods.
I think my favorite part is the hollandaise cube. Love that flavor. And the texture of the bacon, which is something that he pays a lot of attention to. And a lot of chefs sort of forget about that part of the food, which is the contrasting textures.
Yeah.
The egg is, the yolk is kind of gummy, which is not, it's not a usual texture, which makes it great.
What's interesting also about this is that in conventional Eggs Benedict, part of the experience and the memory is that kind of explosion of the egg yolk and giving its hot, warm liquid out. Here, you sort of get that in terms of the mouthfeel from the hollandaise cube.
Well, in one of the few scientific papers on what makes food palatable, the idea of dynamic contrast is examined, and that's the idea that there are different textures within a food. Now, it can be something like ice cream that starts solid and melts in your mouth, or it could be something like a BLT or an Eggs Benedict that has a number of different textures in each bite.
Marcy, you say there isn't much science on how this works, no?
Well, in terms of flavor, you know, you have taste and smell and texture as the primary components. And there are inborn taste preferences. Everybody's born liking sweet. Salt preference isn't there at birth, but it seems to mature without any particular experience. But aromas seem to be learned. So our response to an aroma, what aroma goes with what taste, is a matter of culture and experience. One big controversy is over fat and whether fat preference is something that's learned or is inborn.
I do think that people are super sensitive to texture. Like, in this culture, we don't really like slimy food. Most people don't. In Asian, a lot of cultures, they do love it. And I think there's nothing like crunch. I don't know if that's cultural or not, but I just do think Americans, and I'm one of them, love crunchy food. So anything that's with a deep-fried crust, absolutely love it.
Kettle chips.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, it's all the popular junk foods are crunchy.
There's a lot of sensory psychology. For example, have you ever eaten something very sweet and then taken a sip of wine or orange juice? And we all know that it's horrible.
Yes.
Well, why is that? The reason is that the taste system adapts to stimulation very quickly. So if you eat something sweet, the next bite that you take, you'll be very insensitive
right.
to sweet. So you can use that to play games. You know, you can eat something not so sweet and then take a drink of a beverage or a bite of a food and then eat something very sweet and take another bite, and it'll be completely
different.
Which one
does almost naturally.
Yes.
I think that some of the chefs who are in this so-called molecular gastronomy movement are starting to do that. They're playing with your expectations, mm-hmm. and with temperature as well. A soup that is hot and has cold things in it, or a cold soup with hot things in it, or they'll have something that's a different color than what you, so it looks orange, but it doesn't taste like anything that's usually orange,
mm-hmm.
so that you never really know what to expect as you eat, and you're constantly being surprised. It's really a food as fun and entertainment.
And is it at odds in any natural way or inevitable way with the slow food movement?
Oh, totally. I think they're opposite poles. I was once at a conference with Adria and Alice Waters, and Adria said, "I never want to cook anything that anyone has ever cooked before."
Adria being the great godfather of
Right, the godfather of the molecular gastronomy movement. And Alice was appalled. Alice Waters said, "I never want to cook anything that hasn't been cooked for hundreds of years."
One of the pleasures of this dish was the fried outsideness of this hollandaise cube. Why is that particular texture and taste and warmth combination become so popular in America, that the deep-fried thing?
Well, there are a huge number of things. It's familiar. You know, if there's one question you could ask a person that would tell you more than anything else about what they like, it's where did you grow up?
I think you really do grow up with certain things that have associations to you that they don't have for anyone else. Like one of my favorite meals, which no one else will eat, is packaged macaroni and cheese with hot dogs. I don't have it very often, but I still love it because that's what we have.
When you put your own hot dogs in, or they're
cut up hot dogs. You have to do it yourself. This is cooking. So, but that we had that on Sunday nights when I was a kid.
There seems to be more nostalgia at work today in general and certainly in food than there was when I was a kid.
Well, I think that food companies and, you know, chefs and have become more aware of the power of nostalgia. And you can see that in the neuroanatomy
really?
Of the sense of smell. The emotional part of the brain, the limbic system, co-evolved with the olfactory system. So it's almost impossible to smell something or to appreciate a flavor without having an evaluative response to it. That part of the brain also plays a strong role in memory. So we have memory and emotion and flavor inextricably intertwined.
So Proust, with his Madeleines, was a neuroscientist, as
well,
the book
title
goes.
Yeah.
Thank you both very much.
Our pleasure.
Mine too.
And we got some good food too. So.
Well, free. John Willoughby is the executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, and Marcia Pelshaw is a biopsychologist at the Monell Center in Philadelphia. As for the chef, I want to thank you. It's been great, and the food was fantastic. I could have had, you know, as you say, with my heedlessness about my heart, I could have had a couple more of those. You know?
Well, good. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it.
Wiley Dufresne, thanks very much.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming.
If you want to learn more about the restaurant WD50, Wiley Dufresne, or his strange and wonderful Eggs Benedict, go to Studio360.org, where you can also see pictures of our adventures in his kitchen, as well as up at the farm. Plus, check out our bonus interview with the great author and food journalist Michael Pollan. Michael happens to be the son of Corky Pollan, whom we heard from earlier. And still to come this hour, now please keep this stuff away from your mouths at all costs.
It's really limitless what we can do with this character. It can have 12 eyes and, you know, 6 arms. And that's part of, you know, what we're trying to say. With radiation, the possibilities are limitless.
A true or false quiz about radiation. That's ahead today in Studio 360. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. President-elect Obama is guardedly in favor of nuclear power as part of a solution for climate change. But he's been critical of the Yucca Mountain waste storage site in Nevada. That's where the federal government has wanted to store nuclear waste permanently. Nevadans, not so much. And not the least of the problems for designing any storage site is showing people it's dangerous. The sign can't rust or rot or fade for centuries, eons, and the message on it has to be clear to people in the future who may not speak our language, any of our languages. Studio 360's Sarah Lilly looked into this problem.
If you Google the phrase nuclear fuel pellets, go ahead and do an image search. You'll see a photo of a white-gloved hand gently cupping a palm full of tiny black cylinders. It's as if someone is tidying up after a large mechanical hamster. The stuff doesn't look as if it could kill people for thousands of years. If we're going to bury it deep in the ground forever, it would be good to remember where.
We are thinking, like the Americans, about putting what we call surface markers, like granite stones, that will resist the elements.
Patrick Charton is an engineer for France's National Agency for Radioactive Waste Management.
And on these granite stones, to give them some meaning, we can carve information, either with language or with symbols.
France is really big on nuclear power. So Charton oversees a coterie of scientists, anthropologists, and artists working to solve this problem of society's long-term memory when it comes to waste storage.
If you look at the Japanese, they are working on micro-carving information onto resistant materials and putting these into temples, which are very much revered. They think that the information could last several millennia that way.
There's an obvious problem with this approach.
One of the April, which short saute, the drought of March, had pursed.
That's the opening of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, read by my neighbor, Maria.
Ugh, one to forest, aka him with the soap.
It's hard enough to comprehend something written 600 years ago, much less 6,000 or 20,000. So designers on Patrick Charton's team are working on visual symbols for nuclear waste. We already have a symbol for radioactivity, the one you see on old fallout shelter signs, with the three wedges radiating out from a center dot.
It doesn't look menacing as much as it looks kind of bureaucratic and clunky in a way, you know?
That's Michael Beirut, a partner with the innovative design firm Pentagram. He reminds me that there are a few ancient symbols that still work for us.
But I mean, like, if you think about it, a symbol for what a person looks like, you know, goes all the way back to cave paintings. Arrows as an indication of direction, even though very few of us actually have cause to handle physical arrows for hunting or weapons anymore. You know, and then you wonder whether something like a skull and crossbones, which I have to admit, if I picture it in my mind, it does seem like it has to be forbidding. It, you know, it's a brand taken up by pirates, you know, to kind of strike fear into the hearts of the people that they were doing their pirating thing against.
It's true. Here in the advertising age, we're essentially looking to brand danger. The problem is, the relationship we have to symbols and logos is very subjective.
The perfect example of that is the swastika, where if you look at it, actually, it does look kind of sharp, angular, kind of vaguely menacing.
But the swastika shape was used thousands of years ago in the region around India.
It was, you know, a Buddhist symbol that represented peace and harmony. So the associations we have with it are what make it, quote-unquote, seem evil.
That moving target of how we associate with symbols is top of mind with the waste storage folks like Patrick Charton.
Il faut faire attention qu'il n'y ait pas de contresens.
You need to be careful that there is no reverse meaning. If people want to go 500 meters underground because they have the impression that we've left them some kind of treasure, that's not very good.
C'est pas très bon.
Usually, you know, when archaeologists, you know, the quintessential Indiana Jones is, you know, exploring, you know, the treasure has lots of things warning you away from menacing things, you know, skulls and huge boulders and all kinds of things that sort of are meant to keep you away from this incredible treasure. In this case, those challenges have all been there to try to dissuade you from redoubling your efforts.
All right. We don't want to make nuclear waste sites enticing to thrill seekers. So what should we do?
You know, there might be a case you could make where what you'd want is just kind of putting it in the middle of town in an ugly, stupid building and just surrounded with a lot of things that look half-hearted and inept. Not so much menacing, it's just sort of like tedious and dreary and pointless and just build a kind of anti-mythology around it that way.
There are so many possibilities to consider and a lot at stake.
Considering a distant future in terms of transmitting information requires a bit of humility. Everyone has a different way of saying things. The fact that we have people of many different backgrounds working on this kind of project offers, in my opinion, a better guarantee that it will last over the long term.
And how will he know if they've succeeded?
On sait jamais.
You never know.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
Do you have a good idea for a sign for a nuclear waste storage site? If so, you can email it to us at studio360@wnyc.org. We know that radioactive waste is dangerous, but a while ago, people had some really crazy ideas about the dangers. People thought that if you walked past a nuclear power plant, you might glow in the dark. And then there was the story about a scientist who got zapped with some gamma radiation, and he'd turn into a giant green monster every time he lost his temper.
Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
But that was a comic book, science fiction, fantasy. None of that ever actually happened, right? Well, Studio 360's Eric Malinsky has been doing some paranormal research on the subject.
Every morning at the Department of Developmental Mass at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Laura Buchholz takes ground meat out of the fridge and throws it into an empty chamber lined with lead.
Come on. Okay, here he is. Come on, come on.
A chihuahua named Sparky runs after the food. Dr. Buchholz closes the door.
Wow, he's really going after that meat. And while he's in there, I'm just going to flip the switch. And here he comes. Come on. Come on, come on. Good boy. Good boy.
Sparky looks the same, but Dr. Buchholz measures him with a tape ruler.
I just go around the midsection. I take that measurement. Okay, and then you go head to tail, like that. No, 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 no. Sit, sit, sit. Okay, good boy. Okay, So you wrap it up, and then you do the inseam on the left. On the left. Okay. All right. Sit, sit, sit. And on the right.
Sparky has gained about 5 centimeters around the midsection since April.
And that's actually significant because he's one of our more active dogs.
But the ultimate goal for Dr. Buchholz is not to create bigger chihuahuas. Ever since the human genome was mapped out, scientists have been trying to redraw the blueprint. Dr. Buchholz is using strong doses of radiation to unlock a certain gene called IFG1. It's a natural stopgap mechanism that controls size in most mammals.
You're creating the building blocks as if you were a young person growing, you know, growing out of your clothes, having to buy new shoes every school year, but you're an adult.
Her research is based on an incident that most people would rather forget. In 1954, ants, exposed to huge doses of radiation, grew to the size of cars. They caused damage in New Mexico and California, which was caught on film.
Yeah, this is, see what I mean? Like, this is why this is important, because we never want this to happen again.
But incidents like that don't intimidate Dr. Arun Rath.
Like absinthe and lobotomies, radiation is going to make a comeback.
Dr. Rath is a civilian employee at a bioweapons division at an Army research facility in Maryland. He's following up on experiments that were conducted by the government in the early 60s. By today's standards, these experiments were controversial and unethical. In one trial, government scientists irradiated spiders and had them bite human test subjects.
I can't show you very much of it, but I found a documentary that was circulated among the top military brass at the time.
Ouch, something bit me. It was just a spider. Why do I feel so strange, so different?
One test subject was able to spin webs with his wrist, lift a car in the air, and walk on walls. But after these extraordinary results, he experienced serious side effects, like radiation poisoning.
Once the weakness and radiation poisoning set in, he couldn't even really lift his head off the pillow.
Pentagon officials did not return our phone calls, but they did confirm in an email that they are talking with Dr. Rath about restarting the program. Quote, "As the U.S. prepares to fight more battles on multiple fronts, soldiers with genetic advantages will be invaluable." Dr. Rath admits finding military applications for directed mutation has been a challenge.
There was a man who actually, he only died a few years back. He was bitten by a radioactive sloth. He was able to digest tree leaves, but he didn't really move around very fast, and it was kind of a burden on his family.
But the biggest hurdle may be public relations. The public thinks of radiation as something hazardous. So Dr. Rath is working with an advertising firm to change the way Americans think about radiation.
We did have an ad campaign that was based on the old Palmolive ads. Remember Madge? You know, she would say, "You're soaking in it now," and people would be shocked.
You're soaking in it.
The dishwashing liquid?
Palmolive.
It's going to be same for radiation. You're soaking in it now.
Dr. Buchholz is also aware of the public relations quagmire. She couldn't get funding when she first submitted her grant, which involved creating giant wasps. It turns out the chihuahuas did the trick. And when the dogs reach 5 feet tall, she donates them to a local senior center.
And so the seniors can find them, they can pet them, and it's not as hard to keep track of them. So it makes a lot of sense.
With the map of the human genome as their palette and radiation as their paintbrush, scientists are able to think more creatively than ever.
Radiation is now out of the box.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
I'm like some sort of giant insect, like a wall-crawling human spider.
You can see some pictures of those giant chihuahuas at studio360.org. Thanks to Photoshop. The alleged doctor, Laura Buchholz, is a writer for Prairie Home Companion. Arun Roth is a producer on Frontline and the former editor of our program. Eric Molinsky actually is Eric Molinsky. No chihuahuas were harmed, etc. That's it for Studio 360 today. To hear more from our series on science and creativity, sign up for our new special podcast featuring just those pieces at studio360.org. And while you're there, check out our blog. We're posting from Japan, where we're checking out cultural trends and cutting-edge technology. We'll tell you more about it when we get home. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Rob Weisberg,
Eric Malinsky,
Catherine Epstein,
Greta Cohn,
Emily Frost,
Chloe Plant,
Hamad Ahmed.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the amazing inventor Nikola Tesla makes a new friend.
Mark Twain and Tesla became very, very close after Tesla cured Mark Twain's constipation, which he did by having Mark Twain stand on a metal plate and running an electric charge through his entire body.
Performer Mike Daisy on the genius Nikola Tesla. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.